Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here today for the briefing we're planning on lead, PFCs, and other threats to safe drinking water. The Northeast Midwest Institute and its Safe Drinking Water Research and Policy Program are your hosts today. I'm Michael Goff, president of the Institute. It's just great to have such a good turnout. If you didn't sign in as you came in, please sign in as you leave, because we have materials from the meeting, the presentation outlines, and even an audio recording that we can send to you after the briefing, but we need your email that you were here to do that. As we begin, I want to thank the Northeast Midwest Congressional Coalition, which we work with all the time on the Hill. They're a great ally, great to collaborate with them, and we're grateful for their engagement on behalf of the region. Later in our program, in fact, we're going to be joined by three of Congress's leading advocates on this issue of safe drinking water. We're expecting Congressman Dan Keeldy of Michigan, Congressman Paul Tonko of New York, and Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. There's a House vote right now, so they'll be joining us as they're able later in the briefing. But now let's proceed to what I think you're going to find to be a really interesting and a very timely briefing. We have a very distinguished panel of speakers, and Dr. Sri Padachalan, who's joined the Institute this year as our Director of the Safe Drinking Water Research and Policy Program, who's going to introduce our panelists. So Sri, I'll turn the program over to you.
Yeah. Well, a little too far there.
I know.
Well, I can back you up.
Coming in from there, I guess.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome you all to this briefing on threats to safe drinking water, organized by the Northeast Midwest Institute. My name is Sri Vedachalam. I lead the Safe Drinking Water Research and Policy Program at the Institute. It's also great to have the support from so many members of Congress on this vital issue. I want to thank the office staff of Congressman Keeldy, Fitzpatrick, and Tonko, who made their presence possible. Special thanks to Congressman Tonko, whose office is co-sponsoring this event with us. We are audio recording this event, so we will have slides available, and I expect all the speakers to come in. Do we have a microphone? Right here, okay. So we'll get the questions and Q&A session also going recorded on this device as well. Before we begin today's event, I would like to inform you that we have a briefing tomorrow as well. That is on a somewhat related topic. Tomorrow's briefing will focus on nutrient issues in the upper Mississippi basin and will aim to connect in-stream water quality to nitrate treatment costs. It will begin at 10 a.m. in the room 202 of the Senate Visitor Center, so SVC 202 at 10 a.m. On to today's event. Municipalities and states in the Northeast Midwest region confront serious challenges due to a variety of issues. Aging water and wastewater infrastructure is sort of an all-encompassing term. A combination of reduced federal and state funding, declining population in older cities, suburban migration, stricter standards, and strong local governance in the region all have resulted in a perfect storm. The discovery of lead and perfluorochemicals, PFCs, in our drinking water supplies reinforces the need to constantly guard our water systems from both external and internal threats. The Institute is fortunate to have a reputation that it can leverage in inviting topic experts that can speak on this issue. Although I'd like to think that my voice on those voicemails are doing the trick, but it's good to have all these experts coming in and talking with us. Today we have an excellent panel of speakers. They'll cover topics such as municipal lead service line replacement, lead in daycare centers, lead in schools, and the growing threat from PFCs and algal toxins. Without further ado, I would now like to introduce our first panelist, Tom Neltner. Tom is the EDF's Environmental Defense Fund's Chemical Policy Director, leading efforts to remove or minimize hazardous chemicals from products and the marketplace through cross-cutting policy initiatives. His primary focus is on food additive safety and reducing exposure to lead in our homes and communities. He's a chemical engineer and attorney with experience in chemical safety issues in the workplace, the environment, home, consumer goods, and food. Tom serves on the EPA's Children's Health Protection Advisory Committee and played a leading role in an EPA-convened multi-stakeholder work group that made recommendations to the agency to upgrade its lead in drinking water regulations. Tom.
Thanks, Sri. Go ahead. Stand up here so I can move it. I had some handouts there for you if you happen to have gotten them. One is the slides that I'll be using. Second one is about a lead service line replacement collaborative that has 25 national organizations in it working on lead service line replacement. Another one is on state efforts to support lead service line replacement. There's actually one missing here, New Jersey. We'll talk about that. And then the other one is grading the state, which is a report on state disclosure policies that when you buy a home, how likely are you to be told about a lead service line? And we grade them on an A to an F scale. So we'll cover that real briefly. I'm going to go relatively quickly just to cover the topics and make sure we have enough time for questions. But let me slide over here. So I'm going to focus on lead, primarily lead service lines, and also on child care. So when you look at this, let me just get out of the way here. We all know there's no safe level of exposure to lead. Every time they look, they find that it's got health hazards to it. There's no level at which they've looked and haven't found something. So what is the problem? Well, primarily when you get to young children, before six, that lead gets into the blood. It gets into everybody's blood. But for younger than six, that lead gets into the brain. The blood-brain barrier is not well formed. The lead gets into the brain and causes more damage. So we're mostly worried about children younger than six. It still causes problems as you get older. And for adults, there's no safe level as well. But for children, the damage is more. The safe level, it's not really a safe level. It's an action level that the Centers for Disease Control has established is 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood. And the key thing to remember is that's going to be dropping to 3.5 anytime now. And it's not based on health, it's just based on the number of kids that have these high levels. It's trying to drive the levels down. So where does the lead come from? EPA in January released a report that provides you with relative source contribution. Is it coming from air, water, food, or soil and dust, which is primarily paint, but it could include cleanups. And what we see from this is when you're dealing with 0 to 6 months old, infants, that food's a small source. Soil and dust, i.e. paint, is a bigger source, especially for those that are most exposed. So if you line up all the kids most exposed to least exposed, and then for this one, it's about 200,000 kids in each bar. So just for numbers. You'll see that water is the big source. Where's the water coming from? Primarily made up for infant formula. That's primarily the sources. Water made up for infant formula. These are pretty decent estimates, and they match the overall estimates of what we find in young children. So for kids, young infants, it's water and paint are the primary sources. When you get to 1 to 2 year olds, it shifts dramatically. Kids stop drinking as much water, so you see food going up. A lot of it is like fruit juices and some of those types that where the lead comes from. You'll see paint really soar. And for kids that live in homes with lead-based paint, it's lead-based paint is the biggest source, not surprisingly. And please, it is not eating paint chips. It is dust. It is the kid dragging the stuffed animal, dragging the blankie through the floor and using it and getting exposed that way. It's ingestion from dust is the primary way. And then we have water is relatively small. So it's primarily food, but paint for the most exposed kids. Okay, so how much is too much lead in water? Well, we all know the answer to that, right? How much is too much? Is there any safe level of lead? No safe level of lead. So what EPA said is, did some analysis, is what's the chances of a level in water being enough to push a child into exceeding that reference level. So that reference level of amount in blood that CDC has established, we're anticipating it dropping to 3.5. What they said is, if you're in a home built before 1950, you're probably closer to that limit. So it doesn't take much water to put you over the top. 50 to 1978, where lead-based paint was less common, it's a higher number. And if you have no lead in the dust or soil, you can handle more lead and water. Now, the concept behind this is, how much can we get kids to get them so they've got too much? But we don't want any exposure. But what we found is that if you're dealing with formula-fed infants, if you want to have a very low chance of that child going over that 3.5 micrograms per deciliter in the blood, you want to aim for about 3.8. So we tend to use an environmental defense fund. 3.8 is a working number that if it's above that, for children living in old homes, the water can start to push them over that limit because of the other exposures. So where is it getting into drinking water? Well, we've got the water main. Very rarely do you have any lead in that main, in the water that comes from the main. It picks it up from this service line that connects the main in the street to the house, or to the office building, or to the school, or to the childcare. That service line is often, in 6 million homes, is made of lead. So you're drinking water through a lead pipe. And if that pipe is disturbed, shaken, chemical changes, like what happened in Flint, you're going to get lead particulate and lead solder into the water. It also can come from the meter, from brass valves. Brass valves still are allowed to have up to 0.25% of lead in them, and it can leach into there, and also in older homes, solder that's used to join copper pipe can have it. So it's internal plumbing, and it's the service line. I'm going to focus on the service line because this is can be managed with corrosion control treatment chemicals. It's harder to manage the lead service line because it's a lead pipe. And if that pipe moves, which always happens with temperature changes, you're likely to have more exposure. So looking at the pipe, these are examples of lead pipe. You'll also see steel pipe. Steel pipes corrode. So lead pipe doesn't corrode. So they last 100 years. That's why they were used. They're really nice. You tend never to find them over 2 inches, or never over 3 inches, rarely over 2 inches. So that's why when you get to the big schools, lead service lines aren't an issue. It's only when you're starting at homes or small office buildings or small places. And what happens is they put a corrosion control on it. That's an example of a coating that forms in it. Works really good until it's disturbed. You change the water chemistry, i.e. Flint or Sebring, where the pipe is disturbed because you're removing some of it, fixing it, or the physical shaking of it can release the lead particulate. So in this one, there are 6 million homes is our best estimate. So communities across the country have decided that we shouldn't be drinking water through a lead pipe. It's just not good. 20 years from now, we don't want to be doing that. We don't know how long it's going to take, but we got to start now because we've been 25 years with a rule that EPA has that isn't driving us to replace it, and we've still got these pipes left. That the best way to move us forward is to remove lead and the lead service lines. We still need to do corrosion control. We still need to do all those other things. But replacing the pipe makes a difference. 14 communities have said, we don't want it anymore. Let's get rid of the lead service line. That's real progress. 19 other communities are taking steps. They're not ready to make that commitment, but for example, Philadelphia has said, whenever we do work on a street, we're not going to do any more partial replacements, which increase the lead levels. We're going to get the whole pipe down. So you'll see different communities. We're going to do an inventory. We're going to provide resources. We're going to do mapping. 12 states, on that sheet you saw 11, but 12 states with the addition of New Jersey are doing something, have adopted proactive policies, like providing grants to communities to do this. Wisconsin's the big one on this. New York is just coming on. New Jersey's trying. Virginia, Vermont. Other states are saying consumers, you can use the rate money from consumers that you pay on your water bill to replace the pipe on the private side. Because on the private side, it's often owned by the homeowner. And it makes it more complicated. So rates. There's also other ones doing disclosure and inventory. So we see a lot of states. Most of those states are in New England, the Northeast Midwest jurisdiction. Your states have about 2/3 of all of those lead service lines. These 12 states represent more than half of the lead service lines. So getting progress like that makes a difference. So what are states doing? Setting a goal of replacing them? California, Washington, Michigan, sort of? Enabling the community to secure funding? Indiana, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Vermont, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Requiring an inventory. Illinois. is the best one. Washington State in Indiana, sort of, mandating lead safe work practices. The only one is Illinois right now that's working on that. But requiring disclosure. All states do a different one, and that is this map on the next page. Well, here's the inventory of the states, but I'll slide over to the map. You can see where states rated. So if you live in Connecticut, if you live in Delaware or New York, the seller is required to tell you whether you've got a lead pipe, if they know. If you live in Illinois and Wisconsin, they're required to tell you if you've got a lead pipe and they think the lead pipe is a problem. Other ones just have to tell you what the piping is. So we've got various levels of disclosure. That report gives you those details. But it's not just these communities that are deciding to act. There are 25 national organizations, including all of the utilities that provide drinking water, have all stood up and said, we want to help accelerate water supply replacement in communities. And it's also public health, it's housing, it's the National League of Cities, it's also the consumer advocates at the state level, it's the state drinking water administrators. Lots of 25 groups have all stood up and said, we want to help communities replace it. Because really, at least from EDS perspective, 20 years from now, we shouldn't be drinking water through a pipe. Okay. So here are some resources. Because you've got the paper, I'm going to jump through them. But the Lead Service Line Replacement Collaborative, that's these folks, are a really good resource for all that information. EPA also has a report that gave you those charts that I highlighted. We have a web page. The web page has lots of this information on it, and a health blog that covers a lot of lead. So let me shift now to child care centers. So child care centers have lead service lines when they're small. When they're bigger, it's complicated. But by and large, lead service lines are more on the homeowner side. It's not nor often that you'll find a child care center with them. It's a lot less often than you're going to find them in a school. But when you got them, you need to remove them. But what we did is we looked, because these young children are so vulnerable in these child care centers, we started a pilot where we're looking at, it's about 10 or so child care centers, and we're doing testing and we're doing replacing. So we're trying to replace the faucets, replace whatever we find that's a big source, replace the lead service line. Because we wanted to test it out to see what is a good way to make this work. How can we have this happen more quickly? We picked Michigan, Grand Rapids, Cincinnati, Ohio, Chicago, Illinois, and Starkville, Mississippi. So those are our communities that we're trying this out to try different waters, different approaches. One's a university, one's a nonprofit, one's more allied with the utility, and another one is an energy efficiency group. So we're working to work through those issues for those communities and come up with some models. And Illinois is one state that plans on adopting rules based on this model. I will just give you a few flags. Some people call them day cares. But they're really child cares. They don't take care of days. They take care of children. And if you talk about it as daycare, what you're missing is the point of the exercise, the point of reducing lead. It's about the children. Second, we're focused on the centers, 30, 40, 50, 100 kids. But where are kids, where are a lot of the kids going to be? Daycare or child care homes, smaller ones, that may not be licensed. So we're doing the ones that are in the business of it, and it's a little easier to reach them. The challenges are going to be harder when you get to the smaller centers. These are often private, without the facility support. So Claire can talk about schools. While they're struggling with lead as well, the child care center often doesn't have a facility manager. Or if they do have one, they got lots of other hats on. And they're private, so they don't really feel like they want to deal with lead. They got enough on their plate. So there are some challenges that in child care that may not be quite as strong with the schools, although schools have their own challenges. And this is where we're doing our pilots. So who has standards for lead in drinking water at child care? Connecticut's had them. They just adopted them in 2017 and say you should do testing every 2 years. Illinois is working on it. The legislature said have them done by January 1st, 2018. New Jersey has some licensing standards. Rhode Island has been doing them for a long time on lead. They've been doing the testing, and they do it whenever there's relicensing or post-renovations. Washington State, licensing whenever you get a license, and then every 6 years. And New York City is licensing in every 5 years. Everybody's got a different one. Oregon just launched a program. We don't quite know all the details on it, but they're getting going on a program. So that's a quick run through on lead service lines and on the child care. Why don't I turn it over to Sri, and then you introduce Claire?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Our next speaker is Claire Barnett. She comes to D.C. from Albany, New York. She is founder and executive director of the Healthy Schools Network, a national not-for-profit environmental health research, education, and advocacy organization founded in 1995. And she's also the coordinator of the unincorporated National Coalition for Healthier Schools, co-convened by the network's board and national partners to provide the platform and the forum for environmental health at school. In 2017, Barnett was honored with two national awards, the William K. Riley Award from the American University School of Public Policy for Environmental Leadership, and the American Public Health Association's David P. Rawl Award for Advocacy in Public Health. In 2016, her office championed the nation's first law requiring all public schools to test the tap for lead. Claire, please stand.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Institute for hosting this. This is a great opportunity to talk to a lot of people. I want to recognize a couple of friends in the room. First of all, our State Policy and Communications Advisor, Jeff Jones, who's here today. I appreciate it, and a great partner in all things in New York, Wendy Horde from New York State United Teachers, an affiliate of AFT. So thank you for being here. We're going to talk about healthy spaces for children and exactly what that means. Here's the arrow. So my organization has been in business now since 1995 for children, for the environment, for health, for education, and for the communities. We do research and advocacy and technical assistance. We also sponsor something called National Healthy Schools Day every year. Last year, 2017, was the 15th annual National Healthy Schools Day with about 45 partners. So thinking ahead, from today forward, you have 4 months to plan a wonderful local event. So start clicking through right now. We also put together a number of years ago a collaborative working group around chemical policy reform in schools that advanced a lot of green cleaning products and other kinds of things. And we're certainly hoping that that's going to take on some lead issues as well. Before I really dig into schools, I want to share with you how we frame what we think about schools. Schools themselves are not just, as facilities, are not just little offices. They're very densely occupied. They're used many hours a day, even on weekends. They're crammed full of vulnerable populations. When children are there, they don't have the option to leave. They don't work like little offices. And children, as you've heard, are not just little adults. They breathe more air per pound of body weight, they drink more water, they eat more food, they can't identify hazards, and so forth. So this is a wonderful combination. Now the other part is that constitutionally, education is left to the states, and that means every state has compulsory education laws. So today is a school day, and across the country, there are about 130,000 buildings. We're building in zip codes. 130,000 buildings enrolling about 55, 56 million children. Of that, 100,000 buildings are public in big round numbers, and 50 million kids are in those public schools. There are a lot of different kinds of environmental health hazards in schools. We're going to focus today a little more on lead. But we've got problems with indoor air, mold, moisture, pesticides, radon, PCBs, asthma triggers, and everything else. It's important for this conversation today to realize the average age for public school building in the U.S. is more than 44 years old. That takes them back to before when lead was mostly removed from paint. There's very limited federal and state support for school facility environments. One of the things that has happened as a result of that is the GAO and the National Center for Ed Statistics at the Department of Education have issued multiple reports documenting decades of deferred maintenance and neglect of facilities. So just a couple of quick pictures here to warm you up about the insides of schools. Everybody has heard about asbestos, of course. That is regulated by EPA in terms of schools having to do once every 3 year reports on asbestos containing materials and so forth. The middle shot is actually a courtesy of EPA's what was once a program called the School Chemical Cleanout Campaign, and this is obviously chemistry mismanagement. But it's why you hear news clips every once in a while about chemical spills and things going awry in the chemistry lab. Now, in the upper right, it gets to the lead issue. The lead issue is, this is an elementary school in Pennsylvania, and that is lead-based paint peeling and chipping off of a very damp plaster wall. And the problem the school is concerned about is primarily the wet wall. So they've put a fan on it. So what's that doing? It's blowing the lead dust across the room. And this is an elementary school. Poor maintenance and poor decisions are things that happen as well. The upper right is one of my favorites. We refer to that as a hoarder classroom. Some of you watch crazy TV programs about hoarders. Well, this is a hoarder classroom. Somebody loves their classroom so much they've stuffed it with everything you can possibly get into it, which is expensive to do, and now it means it can't be cleaned or checked. There's no way to get into that and sort it out again. The center slide is a center picture is a student revolt, actually, that's in the Rhode Island State House about cleaning up school buildings. And the upper left is going to remind me to ask the people who are attending the door to keep that door propped open about 6 inches, if you would, please. Thank you. The chart there, the little handheld device, shows 4,000 parts per million CO2. Now, CO2 is what we're all exhaling. And ambient, outside CO2, is normally in the mid-hundreds. But what researchers in Boston and Tulsa and Berkeley and a number of other places have found is that adult critical thinking skills, our ability sitting here in this room to pay attention, to attend a task, and to prioritize, starts a steep decline at 1,000 parts per million CO2. And these kids are in a chemistry classroom with 4,000 parts per million CO2. So that should raise some questions for everybody here who's got a student taking standardized tests. There are several federal efforts regarding lead in school water, and I won't belabor this because I think many of you might be familiar with it. EPA actually does not require schools on municipal systems to test at the tap. If they do, the action level is 20 parts per billion. However, schools with their own water supplies must test and report to EPA about lead, copper, and other contaminants. The U.S. Department of Ag School Meal Program has really come into play here because it's encouraging drinking water versus sugar-sweetened beverages. The program, which is available to all public and low-income private nonprofit schools, requires a twice-annual kitchen inspection in the participating schools for sanitary conditions. But then you have to look at the sanitary code within the state to determine whether or not the sanitary code means no lead in the drinking water. And it tends not to. So here we go. So I have a copy of a report. Tom, if you'd hold that up for me. Great. And there's some outside on the table. So my office does this report about every 3 or 4 years. This happens to be the fourth triennial State of the State's data and policy report, mostly from federal sources. And it's important, again, for this issue to think about what's happening to the profile of public schools today as opposed to where they were 5 years ago, and then think back to when you were in public school. Today versus 4 or 5 years ago, there are fewer public school buildings, but more children in them. And those children have special needs, more are in poverty, more have asthma, autism, and other learning difficulties. But at the federal and state level, there is far less money for schools across public schools across the board. Less money means fewer staff. Fewer staff means fewer non-mandated staff. So those are going to be the custodians and the facility directors and the school nurses and support staff who actually take care of the kids and take care of the building. HP 2020 is a little bit of jargon here. This is the government's Healthy People 2020 report. For those of you who are familiar with the public health work, Healthy People 2020 sets decade goals for certain kinds of things taking place. The Healthy People 2020 update, which took place about a year or two ago, found schools retreating, remember they don't have any money or staff here, schools retreating from their 2010 goals for indoor air quality, for safer pest control, for managing hazardous materials, and for dealing with lead in drinking water. I suspect the lead in drinking water has turned around. There is so much attention to the issue now, I think everybody is jumping on it. If they were to redo the survey today, that wouldn't show up. Skip this. K-12 systems across the country are not all the same. Everybody's educating kids, pre-K or K through 12, but they have very different governance issues at a state level, which I want to bring up because it helps you think about how you're going to solve a problem within the states and with local schools. First of all, again, constitutionally, education is left to the states. There is no regular source of federal funds for school facilities. There are some exceptions to this, FEMA, Department of Defense, tribal nations, and so forth. Local public schools are generally locally funded. They raise their own taxes. The less federal money and less state money is available, the more the local tax has to go up because you still have children in the schools. However, 38 states and jurisdictions, that is, because it includes the district, 38 provide some funding for school facilities. They're not all rich, they're not all sliding scale, but 38 states currently do that. In terms of governance structure, once upon a time, constitutionally speaking, when everybody was setting up K-12 systems, is the states kept their educational systems isolated and sort of walled off from the political arena. But that's not really true anymore. In the last 5 or 10 years, there have been profound changes in the state governance structure on K-12 schools. Just a quick example, in New York, the State Board of Regents is elected by joint session of the legislature. In New Jersey, the governor controls all 13 seats on the State Board of Ed. In Oregon, the governor controls about half. So governors can do a fair amount of things. The State Board of Regents, if they run their own shop, they can do quite a bit as well if they choose to do it. And it doesn't require going to the legislature. However, the next challenge is whether or not health agencies or anyone else has access to a local school. So access to schools is limited in state law and limited in policy. There's some severe limits to that. Getting right into lead in drinking water, this, about 6 weeks or so ago, I was touching base with NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures, and asked them what they were tracking at that point. And this is really interesting. This, by October, they were looking at 44 bills having been introduced in 19 states just on lead in school water. In 2016-17, 8 had been enacted. And remember, New Jersey and Oregon are out of this. They didn't have to go through the legislature, but they were in action as well. So one of the policy challenges is who's actually in charge and what's actually required. Really two different problems here. So the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, runs a survey called SHIPS, School Health Policy and Practice Survey. And back in 2006, about 10 years ago, they, in surveying school health coordinators at a state level and at a local district level, determined that 27 states, they were told, required the inspection of school drinking water outlets for lead. Turns out that's not so. Just in the last year, SHIPS 2016, doing a different level of the survey, heard from respondents that saying that about 50% of districts were requiring schools to inspect outlets for lead. I think that's probably not accurate either. The National Drinking Water Alliance did a briefing here in Washington in September and talked about five laws that were voluntary, five that were mandatory that had been in place. NCSL had picked up eight of those. In addition, ASTO, state and territorial health officials, did a legislative update and tracked 34 bills in 20 states on lead in school and childcare water. What's interesting is of the 14 separate states listed above, SHPS had reported, that is CDC had reported in 2006, that 10 of the 14 already had schools required to test at the tap. So I put this in because I love CDC, but I also want to offer a word of caution and just flag this a little bit, that the world of school health is not the same as the world of school environment. That the physical environment is operated and cared for by people who are not teaching school health. It's important to remember that. Let me talk a little bit in detail about the New York State law that a number of us worked on. Early on in the session in 2016, so just about 2 years ago, there were multiple bills pending in both houses in New York. And we had to try to figure out, as a small coalition of NGOs, how we were going to deal with that. Do we like one better than the other? So what we came up with was sort of what we called our 30,000-foot plan. We needed some sort of a broad base to take a look at that. We wanted testing at the tap. We wanted a plan. We wanted people to know about it. We wanted remediation. We wanted a state report. So towards the end of the session, the governor's program bill was introduced. It addressed all those points. It included testing. It included fixing. It included remediation for schools involved in testing and remediation, which was a critical make or break for us, and also led to a biannual report from the New York State Health Department that was signed. So all the public schools in the state have now tested all their taps, and those results are available. We know that in New York City, which is the nation's single largest school district, that 8% of the taps tested ran over 15 parts per billion. Upstate, which in our definition in New York State is literally upstate plus Long Island, it was 14% of the taps ran over 15 parts per billion. So that's in New York that we are the third largest K-12 system in the country after California and Texas. Right behind us is Florida, and they pick up more kids from Puerto Rico. They may beat us in terms of total enrollment. It's very close. But I think what's interesting about this is how much work got done in a very, very short time, but it also got done because people were willing to do it, they stepped up to it, and they knew there was reimbursement that fit into an existing scheme that other people didn't have to learn about. So some of the early reports, and I'll show, we have to read these a little bit differently. So for example, on the left, the New York State elementary schools, we pulled these from some preliminary work done by the New York State school business officials and school administrators associations. Reading this across, in Buffalo, one elementary school tested all 48 taps, 19 of which were above 15 parts per billion, the highest tap recorded at 105 parts per billion. Down at the bottom, Ithaca, New York, home of Cornell University, one elementary school tested all 128 taps in one building. 21 were above the action level, and the highest recorded was 927 parts per billion. That's way up. National media had picked up and done some other things as well. As you know, media's had a ball with this. So we've got from, just as random examples, Newark, Cleveland, Portland, and North Andover. Portland at 57,600 parts per billion is significant. May have been from a water bubbler. The state school superintendent, and rather the district superintendent, lost her job over that. So the only other thing I will leave you with is to think ahead. You've got 4 months. Think ahead to the 16th Annual National Healthy Schools Day on Tuesday, April 3. And we encourage people to do a lot of different things. We've had blogs and webinars and school walkthroughs and proclamations and resolutions and briefings, all kinds of wonderful things have happened. And we encourage you to take a look at lead in school drinking water and other sources of lead in school. They still have plenty of lead paint, and they're still bringing products with lead into the buildings. Turf, synthetic turf, rifle ranges, lead in art supplies. So it's something to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Next on the list is Alan Robertson. Alan is the Executive Director of the Association of State Drinking Water Administrators, which is whose members are state drinking water agencies. Mr. Robertson has over 27 years of experience in development of drinking water policy and federal drinking water regulations. He has worked in Washington, D.C. on a wide variety of water quantity, water quality, and security and preparedness issues. He continues to provide his technical and policy input on all aspects of drinking water regulations, as well as working on potential amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act. He works closely with EPA and the Department of Homeland Security on ensuring the safety and reliability of water systems. He has published over 35 peer-reviewed publications covering a broad range of drinking water policy and science policy issues, ranging from disinfection byproducts to nitrate to consumer confidence reports to arsenic. Alan?
I want to say thank you to Sri for sending me the invitation, and thanks everyone for coming here. Thank you, Congressman Kildee, for letting me run ahead here. So I've heard you speak before. I think you're a great speaker, so I'll try and wrap up quickly. Real quickly, I just want to talk about who AFTA is and what we do. When people ask who we are, we have 57 members. They're the men and women that run the drinking water programs in the 50 states, 5 territories, the Navajo Nation, and D.C. So we're the eyes and ears for the states and D.C. on drinking water issues. We facilitate the flow of information between the states and EPA, and then also work on information transfer between the states. So we're going to talk about three issues quickly, uncertainties, capital, and then not the regulations. So we're having some drivers that are not regulatory that I want to talk about. So we've got all kinds of uncertainties. We're not sure what the president and Pruitt are going to do in drinking water, or really maybe just in general. We're uncertain about what Congress is going to do. They're working very hard on tax reform, continuing resolution, health care, immigration. There's a lot, so I won't go into that. We have uncertainty on funding, and that could impact the EPA, which can domino into the states. And then we're just not clear on how the deregulatory agenda might impact drinking water. So there's an old proverb says that we live in interesting times, and so I researched this, and it's actually an old Chinese curse, which means you live in interesting times. So we're all here in D.C., so you know what I'm talking about. Capital. There's a lot of talk about infrastructure funding. I think that's very important. That's sort of the traditional financial capital. Related to that is program capital, capital for the drinking water programs. So you look at EPA, the money they need for the drinking water research to develop and implement the standards. It also ties into university research. We want to get the best and brightest to work. And then finally, capital for my members, the states. So I have a white paper I put out back on the challenges we've had in the public water supply supervision program. It's been flat for a decade. It stays flat for a decade, you lose about 30% in funding from inflation, and so that's another problem. But again, the last one is human capital. So you think about the workforce and the aging workforce, and we have a few gray-haired people in the room here, and so we want to attract, again, the best and brightest, and how do we do that so that we have strong drinking water community at EPA, at the states, at water utilities, consulting engineers, and the manufacturers that make the treatment technology. So we have these non-regulatory drivers. A lot of it is just new stuff. The first is a new computer system that EPA is developing that the states will use to submit their information to EPA and then extract it back out. With any large computer software development, there's a lot of issues with that, particularly when you're trying to adapt it to the 57 different entities. We've got new tests to certify the operators who run the treatment plants. These tests have changed where they've removed the regulatory questions. And so our states are trying to figure out how to grapple with that because regulations drive compliance and drive safe drinking water. And then finally, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, has new requirements for buildings, healthcare facilities, to make building water quality management plans. That's primarily to address the growing Legionella issue. The challenge with that is that if a hospital puts in a disinfection system to try and protect the water quality, it now is a new public water supply, so you have increasing numbers, again, while we have this flat funding across the board. And then last but not least, I want to talk about unrelated contaminants. We're seeing an increased level of public expectation. So just meeting the standards is not really a good out. And the two I want to talk about are algotoxin and perfluorinated chemicals. So I got a picture here of Lake Erie showing some of the algal blooms. It's not just in Lake Erie, it's becoming a national issue. New York, Oregon, we've had some issues in Virginia, where I'm a resident. Primarily, the publicity happened in Toledo, Ohio in 2014. They had a do not use order for a few days over the weekend. Like a lot of things, this was a scramble on a Friday afternoon. It was lifted, but then Ohio EPA has now developed a pretty strict testing protocol for all the surface water plies in the state of Ohio. They're kind of a leader on this. In 2015, EPA issued these health advisories for Microcystin and Cylindrops permoxin. But they're kind of a challenge because they're not really a standard. They're kind of a guidance that states can use. But people look at that number as being kind of a de facto standard. EPA developed a response protocol, which helps with the systems and what to do. But again, the states are still struggling with how to enact that. And that's probably going to be more of an issue next year because monitoring is going to start under a rule known as the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. The fourth one starts in January. That's for about 4,000 systems that serve greater than 10,000 people. We're likely going to see detections. And so again, what does that mean now when you detect it compared to those health advisories? And I got just a couple slides here on perfluorinated chemicals. You're probably wondering what this picture is on the bottom here. Has anyone heard of Wolverine worldwide in Michigan? Oh yeah. So it's a manufacturer of shoes at a tannery. So we've got multiple sites kind of scattered around Michigan, both at the factories and some landfills and some legal dump sites, some that may not be legal. This shows some of the strips from there at one of their sites. So it's a growing problem that I've known about for about a decade. It started with the major manufacturing facilities of Teflon and Scotchgard. That was then phased out using PFOA and PFOS. But we've got substitutes now that we're concerned about. Next, we've heard about the aqueous firefighting foam at DOD facilities primarily, but then a lot of city and county fire training academies. We've seen several issues there. And now we're finding other uses that we're seeing. There's an area in New Hampshire where they've had a manufacturer of the fire retardant clothing that has blowers to dry the clothing. That's created an air deposition problem for a lot of private wells in that area in New Hampshire. And again, I show the tannery here. There's some talk about pizza boxes and microwave popcorn and some other uses that are still out there. And again, the point I want to emphasize is evolving knowledge. We're finding more of these compounds in this class. We don't know all the health effects. We're having issues with the analytical methods that I'll talk about. Again, the sources, if it's now we have this air drying facilities. And then how often it occurs, and ultimately, how do you take it out? What kind of treatment will water systems use? And how do our guys verify that treatment is working appropriately? So again, this is my last slide with some details on the PFCs. We had six that were in the last round of UCMR. That was a three-year monitoring program from 2014 to 2016. Everything was going pretty well because we had these old health advisories of 400 and 200. And then at the tail end of the monitoring program, those numbers were lowered to 70 parts per trillion, PFOA and PFOS, plus the sum of the two. So again, we have this evolving knowledge where the numbers were lower based on more reliable health effects data. And that change in the health advisories impacted a lot of systems. There's a system in outside of Colorado Springs that had several wells. All of a sudden now has had to extend a line to the city of Colorado Springs to get surface water. So all their wells were impacted, and they were really caught off guard. And in the meantime, what are states and systems going to be doing now that these health advisories are out there? What other PFCs might be a problem? We've had issues in North Carolina with a substitute known as Gen X. So we're curious, you know, how many other sites have Gen X. The six PFCs and the UCMR method are only an indicator of maybe several hundred. There's a new method now that has either 22 or 23. We're having issues getting reliable standards to be able to calibrate the instruments to go down for all 22 or 23. And what about all the other systems? that weren't greater than 10,000 that we don't have the occurrence data for, and what about private wells? So we have a lot of issues that we need more information about, and EPA just set up a group this week to try and coordinate their research and regulatory development for all the PFCs. So again, that's my concrete information. I'd like to turn it over to the Congressman and hear what he has to say about Flint and some other parts of Michigan. So,
thank you.
We're very grateful to our panel, and we're going to just such excellent presentation, so stimulating, and we have our work to do, and we're very glad to hear all the frightening information, motivated to do something about this. But we're going to move on to questions in a moment, but before that, we have our congressional leadership here. We're very honored to have Congressman Keeldy here, who's been such an ally and such a strong advocate on behalf of safe drinking water. So, Congressman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, first of all, thanks for doing this. This is an issue that obviously is really close to my heart. I never imagined when I came to Congress 5 years ago that it would be a subject that consumed my time here. You know, but being from Flint, growing up in Flint, I'm a Flint kid, and I experienced this water crisis in my hometown in a way unlike anything I ever would have imagined. Before I came to Congress, the work that I had been doing, I led a national organization working on the problems in distressed communities, older industrial cities, a lot of them located in the Northeast and Midwestern United States, but elsewhere as well. And the thing that that work caused me to conclude is that there are some pretty significant systemic challenges in older cities that have not gotten the attention from either national or state policymakers. And the lack of attention to those issues has real consequences. My hometown, what happened in Flint, is one of the consequences of the neglect of these places. And it's not so much just an anomaly, what happened in my community. It's not just a sad tale of a series of mistakes that happened and coincidentally caused this crisis. It was a predictable outcome of an ideology. And it's one that embraces, it's almost irrationally embraces, austerity. Austerity in terms of municipal government. And that austerity is especially manifest in those decisions that are made that can always be put off. It can always kick the can down the road. When the question is, a community facing budget constraints, laying off firefighters or police officers, or delaying maintenance on essential infrastructure, knowing that it's a slow process that degrades that infrastructure, we obviously know what conclusions many communities make. And in my hometown of Flint, that problem was exacerbated by the fact that the problem their financial crisis had gotten so bad that the state had actually taken it over. And in order to save a few dollars, in fact, the sad irony is for about $100 a day of corrosion control and orthophosphate treatment, I wouldn't even be standing here talking about this because the Flint water crisis never would have occurred. That doesn't mean there isn't a need to do more long-term maintenance, but that moment would have been avoided. So we've got to get our arms around this problem. And I see my friend Brian Fitzpatrick walking in. For anybody who ever has any doubt about whether or not Democrats and Republicans, number one, get along, and secondly, can actually do work together, watch Brian and I. We've done some things already, and he's a fairly new member. I worked with his brother, and we worked on issues of water quality as well. So the issues in Flint, I think, are, as much as anything, not some sort of an extreme exception, not some sort of an anomaly, but it's basically a warning that if we don't get this right, if we don't figure out a way to reprioritize reinvestment in these essential systems, what happened in my community will be repeated all over the country. And I think, and this was one of the points that was made, the Flint crisis has opened the eyes of a lot of folks. People don't take it for granted. The testing process is taken far more seriously. And communities are asking questions. Citizens are asking questions, and that's a good thing. of course, what it reveals is a need to go really big in terms of reinvestment. And that's where our work has to get, I think, more focus. Now, you would think that living through the Flint water crisis and continuing to live through it would be, you know, enough for one career for a member of Congress. But in the northern part of my district, I represent a community called Oscoda, which is the location of a former Air Force base, Fort Smith Air Force Base, where we have perfluorinated chemicals. It's hard to say. PFCs. As a result of the use of that fire retardant. And of course, the problem now is the science is evolving on it. And even during this crisis is when we saw the standard, which is an evolving standard as the science is developing, on PFCs. Now, Brian and I were actually able to work together on an amendment that requires the DOD to do significant research on the health implications. And it's a lot bigger than just one Air Force base in northern Michigan. I visited about maybe a year and a half ago the city of Newburgh, New York, whose water system was completely compromised as a result of a PFC contamination emanating from Stewart Air Base. This is a really pervasive problem. It's a big one. You take these two facts, what's happening with the atrophy of our essential infrastructure systems, and particularly drinking water systems, and more Flint, Michigan's on the way, and the evolving science and understanding around the dangers of PFCs. In my hometown, it wasn't just lead, it was Legionella as well. If there's a lesson to all of this, it's the things that we often take for granted are the things we need to be most careful about. Water is one of those things. And if we don't get it right, if we don't figure out a way as a Congress and in our states, it's a shared responsibility to begin to be willing to invest in those things we don't see every day, that infrastructure that we don't drive on, but that we take for granted, we're going to have a big problem. And it's especially important in these older communities, where the ability to finance their way out of this challenge is zero. Because we're talking very often, and this is a particular problem, again, in the Northeast and Midwest. That's why it's important that you're doing this. In communities that have had significant population loss and are making that transition from the old to the new economy in a really difficult way and are already operating on really thin margins and have water systems that were built for a population maybe twice what they currently have with three or four times the wealth that they currently can tax. If we don't see big investment coming from outside those municipal governments, not through just access to cheap credit, but real capital investment, it's not like these communities just sort of go away. They just become really desolate and really dangerous places. And that ought to offend everybody. So we've got our work cut out for us. And I think if we get it right, if we get the message right, and if you do your work the way you have been, folks that Brian and I work with will get the message too, and we'll get our sleeves rolled up and get something done. So thank you. Thanks for letting me take a few minutes.
Well, we're also joined right now by Congressman Ryan Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. And we're very grateful for all you do on behalf of this issue, Congressman, and in particular your amendments that the Congressman just referred to on the PFC issue. Thank you for being here, and we welcome you to the podium too to offer some remarks to us.
Good afternoon, everyone. Sorry we're a little late. Votes ran a little late. So Dan fills in on that. But first and foremost, I want to thank the panel and everyone here for actually keeping a focus on the issue, because as I've learned in my brief time down here in D.C., that's really the key. There are so many distractions and demands on a lot of different issues that it seems like with many members, their attention span can be very short. And the bandwidth is limited based on the number of issues we have to deal with. And there are two that I've really decided to take up and to take a lead role on. One is the opioid issue, which is particularly hurting our district. And the second is the issue of clean and safe drinking water, which has also specifically impacted our issue. And I'm sure, as Dan may have alluded to earlier, the Northeast and the Midwest tend to be, obviously not exclusive, but tend to be more significantly impacted based on the antiquated and the age of our water infrastructure, coupled with the denser populations that we're dealing with. And the case in our community, which is why myself, my colleagues Brendan Boyle and Pat Meehan have sort of teamed up on an issue that is pertinent to our district, which is a military installation, which I think is a common story you'll hear around the country, and the use of the firefighter foams and that going into the groundwater and having a significant impact on the surrounding population. And not only the surrounding population, and this is what always scares us, is everybody that ever was a resident of that military base and is since living in another part of the country that may not be aware of their exposure or even aware of the problem. That's really what we've been trying to take up. Dan mentioned two amendments to the NDA, which are nothing but a start. It's a good start, but it's nothing but a start. The first was a $7 million cash-funded five-year study on the health impacts of PFAS and PFOA. And second is a requirement that DOD find alternative foams to use that are not polluting the groundwater system. It needs to go beyond that. What we're fighting for in our community is remediation, for the Department of Defense to actually pay for health studies because these communities and these residents, due to no fault of their own, many of them are suffering from a manifestation of health consequences, and many others are living in fear, not knowing what the extent of their exposure was and what impact that could have. So that's why we've been really focusing on that, particularly in the Philadelphia suburbs, which were particularly impacted by the Willow Grove Naval Air Station in Warminster and in Willow Grove in the Philly suburbs. And again, thank you for the attention that you're keeping on this issue. That's really the key, as I've learned, with so many different areas of concern, but particularly this one, because unless attention is constantly brought to it and unless you gauge members, and you have quite a few that are dealing with this issue in their districts, but it needs to extend beyond that, because clean and safe drinking water is something that we should all be concerned about. And I just want to thank you guys for inviting me out. Thanks to the Environmental Defense Fund. They do some tremendous work. Tony Kreidlinger is always keeping me fully engaged on this. So appreciate you guys having us. Thank you.
We are open for questions. I think Congressman Tonko is supposed to come sometime. We'll just have him come and join us in between. We're open for some questions now. Yes.
Question, I'm from New York. You were talking. You showed the slide of Lake Erie and the toxic and the algae bloom there. I'm trying to learn about these issues, but the relationship between algae blooms and toxic algae blooms. We had a bloom in Owasco Lake, which is one of the Finger Lakes, famous for clean water. The whole economy depends on it. And the toxics made it through the water treatment plant with coming out people's taps in the town of Auburn, New York. Is that a common occurrence now? Is that something that's going to be happening more and more? How unique is that situation?
Can you just briefly
repeat the question? No problem. So the question is the outbreak that was in Auburn, New York, and you know, the having it go through the treatment plant and end up in people's houses. The short answer is it was a little bit unique. That the reality is that there's pretty well understood treatment on how to either remove the algae through the settling and the filtration, or then oxidize, break up the toxins through addition of chlorine or other disinfectants. But you gotta be on top of it. That's maybe the best way to describe it, is that it's not completely simple. There have been tools developed by the American Water Works Association and the Water Research Foundation that help utilities try and get ahead of the curve and understand if you just have, because you can have algae and not have any of the algae that create the toxins. You can have algae and it hasn't created any toxins yet, just the way it's formed. And then you can have the toxins, which then you have to oxidize at the end of it. So you have to kind of know where you are with that. And it's understandable, but it's not simple. Tom, I don't know if you're a chemical engineer. You might be able to add something to this.
No, it's a great summary. And it's also just not cylindrous bromoxin or microcystine. Those are just the two that have been understood from a health standpoint. There's many other ones that are in there that just aren't understood yet.
If I could just take it one more step, I wasn't clear. People that I've talked to about this were not clear whether what we're talking about. It's a very old city, probably a very old water treatment plant. And can that plant handle this problem? And this problem, we assume, is tied to warming. The lakes are getting warmer. And so I'm assuming that we're going to be seeing more of this in some of our colder northern areas.
Yeah, so two questions there. One about the age of the plant and then sort of the increased temperature. So the age of the plant, to be honest, really didn't have anything to do with it. That it's because it's conventional treatment. You don't really need advanced treatment. You just need to be able to understand how to optimize your settling and filtration and then when and how to apply your disinfectant to oxidize if needed. It's a little complicated, but the age of the plant is less a concern than making sure you know how that algae bloom and the toxin development is evolving over time. The question about the warming temperature is just sort of a generally yes, that warmer temperatures are more conducive, but algae blooms are pretty complicated as far as how they're formed. So Lake Erie has consistent problems with the shallowest of the Great Lakes. So shallow lakes have a higher tendency to get algae blooms than deeper lakes. So that just it's a function of the limnology of lakes, and I'm not a limnologist, so I don't want to pretend to try and get into other than shallower lakes are more of an issue. Temperatures can impact, but it can also be not just warmer temperatures, but how it warms and how long it warms, and then even when a rain might come and it might run off the runoff of a fertilizer application upstream. In my experience in the area, this area, the local area, I'm on the board of directors of Fairfax Water, so Fairfax gets the bulk of their supply from the Potomac River, but has a reservoir, Occoquan, down kind of by the Lorton area. It's a deeper reservoir, which helps a little bit. There's also not a lot of agriculture there, but yet they manage the water quality in that reservoir by having an oxygen bubbler system at the bottom, going along the bottom near the dam to try and maintain the dissolved oxygen along the bottom. And that was the investment they made to try and maintain as much for nutrient issues that they've also managed through zoning, but also iron and manganese that might be in the sediments in the bottom. So there are a lot of strategies in reservoir management. Well, let's go all the way up watershed management, getting the farmers to try and manage how they put down the fertilizer or even discharges from wastewater plants. There is reservoir management, and then there's actual treatment. So there's kind of a three-stage approach to trying to make it all work, and you kind of have to make it work together. So there's some interesting new technology in satellite detection that we got two or three states to collaborate with the folks at Goddard to try and use some of that data as an early warning system, and that shows some promise because the satellite imagery has gotten so much better, like everything else is. If you think about your cell phone camera now versus, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, and you can imagine they've done the same thing with satellites. So I don't know if anyone else on the panel wants to add to that. So
well said.
I have a question for Greg, actually. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the jurisdictional issues that schools have in relation to local governments and state. Mm-hmm. So is it possible that you could have a state law that provides for testing of all that in schools, and many of the schools could not be covered by that? How is that possible?
Well, if you have an enacted law that specifies who's going to do the testing, where they're going to do the testing, and they have to have access, then you've cleared it. Or in the case of some places, like which are called dependent school districts, they are creatures of city government or creatures of county government. So New York City, for example, is now a department of New York City government.
But then you have these independent school districts.
There are about 13,000 independent school districts with about 100,000 different buildings. And so they can, in fact, deny access to a health agency if they want to, or to a utility. There was a preliminary study, a pilot study, I think, in California about a year ago, where the local utility was going to provide free sampling at the tap, but schools would voluntarily invite them in, and when they were there, point out which tap was going to be tested. This led to a finding of no lead. So I think it's really important to think about one of the options. One of the things that is interesting to me is whether or not states have the ability to redefine sanitary inspections to include lead at the tap. I think that's a really interesting possibility. I think that there's some other ways to get around it. But schools do have to have fire safety inspections. They do have to have food safety inspections. But it tends to be at their request when they are ready to have the building looked at. I don't know how well it would work for lead at the tap.
Thank you.
But just to finish it off, our preference would be to have the utility or the local health agency do the testing, not to have the school themselves try to figure out how to do it and keep track of it. I want to add one more thought because it's come up in a number of other discussions that we've had around lead in schools and how to remediate. We don't know yet from New York State, because that report hasn't been done, on the actual embedded cost, because the cost of testing and remediation was put into an existing formula. There wasn't a new add. So we don't know what that whole cost is yet, but we're really interested and we want to find out more about what's happening in terms of remediation. There are folks who want people to install filters on taps, which is certainly something that can be done. Organizationally, because of what we know about schools, public and private, and the lack of maintenance and the lack of repair, and the fact that they're still breathing dirty air, even though you can smell it and touch it and taste it, I'm really reluctant to think that filters are a good idea, because once they're installed, they're going to be there for a very, very long time, and it's unlikely somebody would look at them again. So we're very interested in the hard capital cost of the fixtures and the pipes in the buildings. We're not seeing any service lines. In the New York State reports that we have access to, none of the 4,500 schools that have reported to the state have reporting lead service lines. They have galvanized, they have iron, they have PVC. No lead service lines are showing up.
Tom, I know you have some thoughts on filters.
On what?
On the use of filters as...
Filters are hard to maintain. You know, you put them on your faucet, you never replace it, and it creates a maintenance one for people that are already overwhelmed with maintenance responsibilities as it is. Mm-hmm. However, they are good at reducing the lead if you keep them up.
Until they fill up with lead.
So it's better to solve, as an engineer, you want to solve the problem and not have to remove it that way with the filter, but filters are a great stopgap, mm-hmm. as long as you think of them as a stopgap.
Yes.
Hi, John Rumpler from Clean Water Program Director for Environment America. My question for Mr. Robertson, you had mentioned treatment, but then reservoirs, and then watershed protection. I'm curious, are there among your members folks that have used source water protection plans to great effect to prevent or reduce the likelihood of toxic algal blooms?
The short answer is yes, but it's all over the map. We have a handful of states that, it's primarily the states that have had the issues with it, New York and Oregon and some others, Minnesota, where they've been able to do that. The issue is always, like it is in any issue, is the money, we're trying to work. I co-chair a group called the Source Water Collaborative. It's similar to the lead service line, but it has 27 different organizations trying to address source water issues. And one thing we're going to focus on next year is the Farm Bill. And AWA is promoting taking 10% of the conservation money and focusing it on source water protection. And we want to try and support that and figure out what we can do. Given my role in representing state agencies, we kind of play a soft touch in doing information and advocacy on the Hill, but some of the organizations can take a little more of a direct approach. And so we hope to organize a coalition on the Farm Bill that will focus on exactly that. So, and it's not just
the algal toxins, there's a briefing tomorrow on nitrate in Southern Delaware Mississippi River, and that's still a pretty big issue. Nitrate from drinking water violations, the reg came out in 1991, the numbers haven't gone down a whole lot. So one system gets fixed and another one pops up. They've gone down somewhat, but they've kind of stayed stable on nitrate violations, and that's another contaminant that we're continuing to be concerned with. So the short answer is, it's kind of a yes and no answer. We've seen some positive steps, but more taken are needed.
Any extra questions? All right. I want to thank all of you for attending. I want to thank the panelists for